Chapter 21. David. Rhonda Davenport is a waterfall. An enormous wall of silken aqua and teal spilling in layered sheets off shoulders that are like great fleshy cliffs. Her hair is bedroom blonde, pillowed and fluffed and curled. She is taller than I am. I conclude that she was probably a real looker in her day, before Jack and his ill-fated pancreas. She has overburdened her cracker with hummus, and because I am a freak of powerless concern whenever I am back in the place of my upbringing, I am preoccupied with the well-being of my mother's carpet. I am readying the napkin that tightly wraps my glass of wine, preparing to thrust it forward, plucking lumps of tumbling hors d'oeuvres from midair. But the hummus clears the teeth without incident, and I relax. Rhonda washes it down and continues. "Anyway," she says, "I probably spend 2 or 3 hours a day on eBay. I've made 26,000 so far this year. Last year I made 12, but I was still getting the hang of things." I act impressed, because I am impressed, but mostly because I cannot fathom spending that much of my life plugged into an electronic garage sale. My mother breezes by to deliver a plate of crab cakes and to fuss with the crudité. She is in dangly earrings and a light blue dress that flares at the heels and makes her strangely tall and elegant. She is still wearing her apron. To eat is human, to cook is divine. She looks older than I remember. She has always looked older than I remember. Older than when I was a child asking to stay over at Pete Wilson's house. Older than when I was 17, watching her, pregnant with Ben, haul Tilly, screaming up the staircase. "You leave him alone! You leave him alone!" as my father lectured me about responsibility and consequences, and about the merciful forbearance of Inga and Heinrich van Susteren, whose house had been trashed and whose fish had been killed, all for the sake of my autographed Dan Marino football. Older than earlier in the evening, when she grilled me about May's absence, when she handed me a slip of paper and told me to write out a review of Tilly's movie she knew I would not write. It's not so much that she looks old, which she doesn't, or that she is getting older before my eyes, which I suppose she is, undetectably. It's that I am forever stuck with the historian's perspective. The way things are is for me the way things were. At least until I open my eyes and pay attention and look around and realize that things are as they are, not as they were. She kisses me on the cheek, the same as she always has. "He's a good boy, Rhonda. I'm telling you, he's a good one." "Baby doll, he's not a boy anymore. He is all man." Rhonda lets out her trademark bellow and pats me on the cheek. I can feel myself blushing. "Oh, Rhonda, wait till you see his girlfriend. Wait till you see May. Is she here yet, David? I haven't seen her yet." She is festive and gay, my mother. She's got her party game face on, asking questions to which she already knows the answers, but asking in an excited and animated way that makes answers irrelevant. She is Ricardo Montalban on Fantasy Island and maybe a little bit of Speed. "Smiles, everyone, smiles." "No, Mom, I told you, I don't even know if May is..." "Now she is a good-looking woman. She's sick a lot for someone who looks so healthy, but she will knock your eyes out." "Mom." "Yeah?" Rhonda looks at me appraisingly. "Got himself a looker, does he?" "Rhonda, I'm telling you, you've never seen a better-looking couple. They should be in a magazine. I kid you not, she's a goddess, a model."
"Oh, a model."
"She's not a model, Rhonda," I say.
"Oh, David, no, she's not a model. She's a lawyer."
"She's a paralegal, Mom."
"Whatever. She's gorgeous and her parents are lovely and they have a beautiful, just luxurious home up there on the water with this fabulous 50-foot sailboat. Oh, wait till you meet her, Rhonda. Just wait. She should be here any minute."
"Mom."
"Well, good for you, David."
Rhonda pokes me in the chest with a bejeweled finger.
"Good for you. Good to know somebody in the world is still getting laid on a regular basis. What's it like having hot sex on a sailboat?" "Oh, Rhonda."
Mom shakes her head and bustles off into the kitchen, pretending to be amused
rather than offended. She is not prudish, as she is often quick to declare, but she has a compulsive allegiance with social decorum that prevents her from encouraging ribald humor. Best to leave the room shaking her head in mock delight. Rhonda Davenport, on the other hand, has a compulsive allegiance with ribald humor, which prevents her from encouraging social decorum. Rhonda bellows again, drawing looks from around the room. She pops in another small mountain of hummus and picks up where she left off, the internet. Inquiring about my own surfing habits, I tell her that I have never really had the time or interest for idle surfing, leaving out the greater truth that I do not have access to a computer that does not belong to either my girlfriend or my employer, neither of whom have been very keen of late to grant me access to much of anything. I could purchase another porn-free computer of my own and resume my relationship with my own internet service provider, but I would rather eat and stay warm in the winter. Rhonda does not need to know these details. She segues into her own not-so-secret penchant for porn. For those of us without the real thing, as she is fond of saying, asking if I have seen the latest video of the guy with a Johnson so large that he's made a series of hats and little tubular outfits for it. David, it's hysterical, she says. Give me your email address, I'll send you the video. A baseball player, and the English sea captain, and the Navy guy, and the policeman, they do these little skits. Someone in his family is an incredible seamstress. The construction worker is a scream. He wears this little denim number and this yellow hard hat. I am saved by Peaches Pinkle, who has just arrived with her husband Harris. As I shake Harris's hand, Peaches gives me a hug and tells me I'm looking smart. You always look so smart, David. You and Tilly are the smartest, best-looking kids I've ever seen. Then she adds, without taking a breath, Now, where might an old woman get a glass of scotch? I take her to the kitchen, leaving Rhonda with Harris. There is no scotch. I refresh my wine and offer a glass to Peaches, but she's not having any and continues to scrutinize the liquor cabinet with the same abject desperation of a teenager leaning on an open refrigerator door. Jude Dobbs appears from behind with a clap on my shoulder. He is very tan and his hair is thinning, and he is sporting a pair of sunglasses that hang outside his shirt pocket, pulling the thin cream silk out and down, like his chest is in the process of emptying itself into a single, odd-shaped breast. Jude, I see, has discovered green-tinted contacts. I half expect him to meow, which might have been oddly refreshing. Instead, we talk about how well I've been, how good I look, and how I am taller than he remembers, and how busy I have been, how truly wonderfully terrific and great I have been lately, given the long stretch of nice weather, amazing weather, incredible with the sun and all, and the unquestionable promise of the Buckeyes this year, and of how he and Mickey have been great and wonderful and terrific and very busy and enjoying the great weather we've been having, and how they have bought some land up at Christopher Lake, and how they are looking into buying a boat, and how he wants to talk to my father about that, and where is my father anyway, and how my mother looks great as usual, and... I am saved by Dr. Swenson, who waves to me from the dining room, drawing me out of the single-breasted, brain-sucking feline vortex of Jude Dobbs, who, as I step sideways from the kitchen, I can hear pouncing on Peaches. Peaches, old gal! What are you, alphabetizing the entire liquor cabinet? Swenson is a pleasant relief. We talk about Tilly, mostly, about how he knew from the first moments of her life that she would amount to something, about how thoughtful it was of my parents to include him and Dana in this celebration. We talk about Peppermint Grove, and about how convincing Tilly is as Katie Finn, and how quickly she is maturing, recalling her earlier movies with that high, silly laugh. He asks about school, and I give him the mixed review version. The kids are great, but are challenging. The administration is awful, but has its moments. I decide to leave out the part about being suspended and arrested and under suspicion for the still theoretical but entirely possible, if not anticipated, rape and murder of a student. What is he to do with such details? What am I to do with such details? My work turns to his work, and I ask about his practice, which I realize almost instantly is a bad move. He has been sued. Not a big deal, he says. Part of the job, he says. But still, he wants to talk about tort reform. He wants to talk about trial lawyers and the litigious entitlement culture. There needs to be some serious legislation, David. Bush needs to move this up on his agenda. He needs to spend some of that political capital. I'm all for the Iraq effort, but there's a war going on right here at home. I check out of the conversation, putting my head nodding on autopilot. May has not arrived, and I'm convinced she is not coming. I am simultaneously distressed and relieved. Not coming to the party would mean that dinner together and the laughing and the sex had not been a reconciliation. It would mean that she is, at best, still conflicted. It could even mean that May has sampled the prospect of reconciliation and has concluded that she is not at all interested. That thought is awful, depressing, maybe even devastating. It is confirmation of my lot in life and the state of my existence. When I am not overcome with angst about whether May will suddenly step through the front door, I am filled with an oddly calm assurance that all is as it was ever intended for me. Past Dr. Swenson's shoulder, I can see the front door open. I am instantly flooded with a bright hope, reconfiguring my worth and replotting my life's trajectory. I am now sheepishly amused at my former ambivalence and my tendency to shrink from fortune. But it is not May. It is my father and a woman in yellow I do not know. My mother joins them in the foyer and pantomimes through the gracious hostess welcome to our home routine. My mood dims again into a muddy, fatalistic mixture of angst and disappointment and inexplicable relief. I tune back in. Dr. Swenson is now on to the issues of taxes and tax relief and the dangers of creeping economic disincentive that will stifle production. The entitlement culture is cutting its own throat, David, because eventually, those in the world who produce will eventually throw up their hands and stop producing, and there will be nothing left to be entitled to. He wants to know if I've read. Atlas shrugged. I'm saved by a woman in a sport coat trying to squeeze behind me to get to the crab cakes. She smiles at me seriously and tells me her name is Gail as she stretches for the table. A tattoo of something sinuous emerges from the cuff of her sleeve, but I cannot make it out. Red, trimmed in blue. But the blue has not known its place, and the red has not held the line, and the blue has made atomized inland incursions over its twisting borders into foreign epidermal planes, making the red mottled and resentful. I introduce myself, and then Dr. Swenson, and she brightens when she learns that I am my mother's son. She is a friend from the Finger Hut campaign, she tells me. She calls my mother a real gutsy lady with a lot of class. Dr. Swenson and I emphatically agree, but I have absolutely no idea what I mean by my agreement. If anyone can get me through the rest of the Voinovich and Bush administrations, Gail says, coming down hard and decisively on the crab cake, it's gonna be your mother. She chews at us, and we watch her in silence for an awkward moment. That may be, says Dr. Swenson finally, but I think you may be a little out of step with the country about Bush. Give his second term a chance. He smiles encouragingly. You might be surprised. I'm getting tired of Bush surprises, thank you, she says, as if that might end things. But Dr. Swenson is not done. I'm not saying he's perfect, mind you. There's plenty in this country that needs attention. I was just telling David that what we really need is some serious tax reform with attention to the economic incentives that... I'm saved by my mother, suddenly at my side with a hand on my shoulder. David, I'd like to introduce you to someone. She gestures to the beaming figure in yellow standing next to her. This is Bethany Cohen, a friend of your father. Well, the daughter of a friend of your father. Visiting from California. New York, actually, says Bethany, shaking my hand. I'm from California, but I go to school in New York.
What school?
Columbia, she says.
Good school.
I guess. She shrugs as though it's really no big deal. My mother disappears into the kitchen with an exclamation about something still in the oven. What brings you to Ohio? I ask, glancing hopefully at the front door for May. I'm looking at business schools.
You're leaving New York? to come to Ohio for business school?
Crazy?
A little backwards, yeah. An MBA from Columbia is nothing to sneeze at.
I'm tired of New York. I'd like to settle down someplace quieter, more wholesome, less, you know, New York. Hollis has been really great about showing me around. He's such a sweet man.
Well, I think sweet may be debatable, but you sure found the right guy. He knows just about everyone in the state. He can open a door or two for you in Ohio.
Maybe Ohio, maybe not. I'm off to Michigan next, then Illinois, then Texas.
Texas?
Then to California. Yeah, any place but New York.
Well, I say, I guess you can't get much more wholesome than California.
Hey now, she objects. Some parts of California can still do wholesome.
Yeah, I guess L.A. can do wholesome in a sexy, violent, depraved sort of way.
David, there's more to California than just L.A.
Nah, it's all Hollywood if you ask me.
Hollywood!
She grabs my forearm and squeezes it, like the restraining bar of a roller coaster car.
I cannot believe your sister is Tilly Johns. I'm still reeling.
Yeah, so were we. We thought she was a flight attendant.
No way.
Yeah, went to a movie one night and there she was, 40 feet tall. She is staring at me with her mouth open slightly. Frozen, she reads my face and processes my words. Not real bright, this one.
That's not true, she says, catching on, smiling as her cheeks redden.
You're right. I actually saw her first movie on a plane, so she was only about, 5 inches or so. I show her what 5 inches looks like between my fingers. She is laughing hard now, eyes closed, knees bending. I see that I have mistaken guileless innocence for low intelligence. Either that or the whole thing is a put-on. God, am I so cynical now, so suspicious, so bitter that I cannot appreciate genuine, trusting, unsullied innocence when it introduces itself, even if it is lovely and wearing yellow? She is still laughing. Yes, I am just that cynical. When she has pulled herself together, she dabs her eyes with the back of her hand and says,
I see a good sense of humor runs in the family.
Oh, you should be here for Christmas around the tree. We're a riot.
Does your sister come home for Christmas?
Not if she can help it, I tell her.
She's probably really busy with her career and all. Gosh, yeah, that's true. I'm sure she'd come home if she could.
It is a kind of assumption that I choose not to correct. Why bring the truth into it? After all, the entire evening is deliberately at odds with reality. Even tonight, I am not so much of an asshole as to start maliciously spreading the truth. Especially to this Bethany person, who, in the company of my father, might have been told just about anything. I'll not be the one to shatter the pleasant illusions about my family. I am fairly certain that the motto inscribed in elaborately scripted Latin, like a cursive rainbow over the Johns family crest, which is probably two ferocious lions on either side of an English commode, must be something like, preserve the fiction. She is holding small sheets of paper and a pen, which she waves at me. She smiles.
I'm supposed to write a short review of Peppermint Grove.
Ah, yes.
Have you done yours? She asks.
I shake my head and take a drink.
Yeah, that's just not gonna happen. You didn't like it?
The movie? Oh, it was great, and she's great in it.
Then why?
Because secretly Tilly'll hate this little exercise, and because I love her, and because I have a solemn obligation as her sibling to abstain from lending any encouragement to any ideas that will make Tilly want to pull her hair out of her head.
Really?
She asks. Her hair is very important to her.
Oh, she swats in the direction of my chest. I can't tell if you're serious or if you're joking.
I never joke. I hold up my right hand as though I'm being sworn. She is definitely cute, and I am definitely performing. I take another furtive look at the door.
You're swearing on a glass of wine, she says.
What else? The Bible? The Constitution? Never betray a glass of wine. That's what I always say.
No, I don't think so, David. That's not you.
You're right, I say. That's my father's line. I know that's not true.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, she says. I happen to know that your father is devoted to moderation in all things.
You've learned that, have you?
Yes, he is a very wise man, very principled, very, spiritual, and very knowledgeable. He knows, like, everything. I've been so impressed with him.
He knows everyone, maybe, but not everything.
Well, she laughs and points at me with her pen. He doesn't know who Mike O'Donnell is. I found that out the other day.
Not surprised. He's not a real big pop culture kind of guy.
Don't tell me you're an O'Donnell fan. I met him once, she says.
I'm sorry to hear that. You okay?
He was really sweet.
Now who's the jokester?
No, really. He did a book signing at NYU last year and I went.
You mean you actually purchased his book?
Didn't have to, she says. He gave me one and autographed it for me. I didn't even make it through the line. There were so many people, and eventually he stopped signing and everyone left. And so I thought, well, that was that, and I talked to some friends for a while and then headed out to the parking lot, and I turned around and there's Mike O'Donnell coming in my direction. And he says, hello, like he was just a normal person.
Nice trick, I say.
No, he was really sweet and he gave me a copy of the book.
What book?
His novel, Those Who Traipse.
Oh, sheesh.
Well, yeah, I know, but it was the only book he actually had on him. He gave it to me and asked where he could get a good cup of coffee.
You're kidding.
No, really. We went to this bistro place, and it was really just a nice time.
You went on a date with Mike O'Donnell?
It wasn't a date.
She swats at me again.
It was coffee. It was, I don't know, 45 minutes, maybe an hour. He signed the book.
What did you talk about?
Mostly the sort of life he leads, the people he knows. What it's like arranging an interview with the president. He has a lot of responsibility and a lot of pressure.
The president?
No, Mike O'Donnell.
Ah.
We talked about how he needs to work on his anger.
Really?
He said he needs to stop letting people who hate this country keep pushing his buttons. He said getting angry only encourages them.
Them, the America bashers?
Right. You know he'll be in Cincinnati tomorrow night?
Oh?
I pretend that this information has piqued some latent urge to see this crazy right-wing douchebag in person. Yes, then he'll be in Columbus. He did this one broadcast right after the election. I am saved by my mother, who reemerges from the kitchen with a hot mitt. Where is my... There it is.
She grabs a glass of wine from the table and does a quick survey of the hors d'oeuvres, and then of the human assemblage in the living room beyond, as she takes a drink.
Is May here yet?
Mom.
Well, she'll be here. She will, David. You leave Bethany alone now. She needs to write her review before we call Tilly. You can sit right over here, dear. Oh, okay,
Bethany says, smiling like an 8-year-old on Christmas morning.
I'll tell you later, David.
Duty calls, I say, trying for the gracious in disappointment tone as she takes her leave. I can sense that my mother is not done with me. She wants to vent some more about Dad's lack of assistance with the party, or she wants to send me around the room with bottles of wine or to chat up someone in need of conversation.
David,
my mother says, having cleared a place for Bethany at the table. Back in a sec, Mom. I wriggle free and head across the living room with a determined step, suggesting a purpose I do not have. It is enough to escape interception. I make it to the back window and the relative peace of the area behind the couch. I think of laying down right here, simply disappearing behind the sofa. The backyard is dark and moody, except for a pond of light spilling onto the lawn from Ben's window. Enough light to make out the cotoneasters, but not enough to illuminate the difference between rescue and abduction. Ben is there, his shadow swimming in the pale pool. He is dancing and swaying, his arms over his head, spinning and bending. It is the perfect antidote to everything I am feeling. I fantasize about abducting him again, off for ice cream or maybe bowling or another movie,
Of course, I would never be forgiven, and this makes the fantasy even more tantalizing. I get out the front door undetected and make it around the back of the house, same as before. The window is unlocked, and Ben is ecstatic to see me. But he knows this time to be quiet, and he is dressed and his shoes are on, and he is out the window and we are off, running in the shadows and hunching low to stay beneath the windows. He pauses when I pause. He runs when I run. Quiet as mice, all the way. But my fantasy from behind the couch makes it only as far as my despoiled Civic at the end of the driveway. It ruins things, like a projector bulb melting through celluloid, to imagine buckling Ben into the rapist mobile, or to think of people pulling up to us at stoplights and reading that word, rapist, beneath the window that frames my brother and all of his innocent exuberance. I imagine that wherever we go, Detective North will be half a block behind, drinking coffee from a paper cup or obsessively grinding gum between his teeth or smoking or grunting unintelligible phrases into his radio speaker or whatever else staked out cops do with themselves. And because he is bored and frustrated, North will pull me over. He will hit his lights and pump his siren and pull me over with my brother in the car. And he will ask me to please step out of the vehicle so he can follow me back to his car and have a brief, terse conversation about something meaningless. "Just want you to know, Mr. Johns, we still have no sign of Brittany Klein, who did not show for her recital, and we're talking to everyone at the school because the department has made the case a top priority. Just to remind me that I am under suspicion and that he is watching, just to make sure I do not ever relax about Brittany Klein. Maybe just to rattle me up a little as my brother sits in the passenger seat and fidgets with his hands until he wants to get out and come find me and see what I am doing in a police car." And North steps out of the car and points and barks at him. At Ben, my brother. "Please, sir, remain in the vehicle." And that is the moment. The moment North's voice, in little, invisible packets of concussed air, sails through the night along some crowded Columbus Boulevard and touches the outer cochlea of my brother's ear. That I will have to unclip the shotgun from North's dashboard and... I pull the plug on the fantasy with another drink of wine and acknowledge silently to myself that the "everything will work out fine" mantra is now completely worn out and no longer doing its job. Aside from May, I have no one but the police and my lawyer to talk to about my fate, and neither of them is particularly comforting. Ben's shadow does another pirouette and bends and straightens and bends and straightens like a tree laughing its way through a violent storm. The financial implications of my situation choose this moment to reintroduce themselves with a vengeance. Next week, Principal Robert B. Robertson III will pick up a pen with his meaty little fingers and change the character of my suspension from investigative to disciplinary. Without pay. As his stupid plastic bulldog nods in agreement. "Ain't that right, bully? Ain't that right, bully?" Fucking plastic bobblehead dog. Who makes those things? Are there bobblehead factories? Who keeps them on their desks? I have almost nothing in savings. The mortgage is due in, what, 2 weeks? I will soon be getting a bill from Glenda Laveau of Cheney Baker Smith & Lyons for an amount I certainly cannot afford. And while I would like to think her services will no longer be necessary, who am I kidding? He's still out there. He's following me, for Christ's sakes. He's not quitting. He's probably down the street right now, either him or one of his stupid cop partners. The only way out of this is whenever stupid Brittany Klein comes out of hiding. Even then, it's a safe bet that Brittany hates me. What if she lies to get back at me for rejecting her and taking her drugs, to cover up for whatever shit she's into, and to deflect a lot of tough questions about what she's been doing and about pot and ecstasy and coke and nightclubs and horny teachers? And, goddammit, she does have some things she can say. I was there, and I did dance, and they were drinking, and there was a kiss, and I did take her drugs. What an asshole. Nice one, Dave. Way to use your head. Shit. What if she actually turns up dead? Ever think of that? That ought to be worth a few $1 billion in legal defense. If I'm actually charged with something, I suppose I could get a public defender, but is this really the time to be bargain shopping? I close my eyes and take a breath and try to get a grip. I focus on Ben's shadow, twisting and bending and laughing in that silent wind of his, until I can force a better perspective on my own thoughts. Everything will work out fine. Everything will work out fine. Everything will work out fine. It would help to have someone to talk to. Someone I can trust and who did not want to bill me or arrest me or fire me, and who I had no interest in betting. Someone to just talk to. In the reflection of the living room window, I can see the party in the room behind me. My father has made his appearance. He is making his way through the room, person to person, hand to hand, his course marked by a trail of hugs and laughter. They love him. People love him. He is the great communicator in the same way that Ronald Reagan was the great communicator. The gift of Hollywood to politics. Of knowing what to say and how to say it. How to hit the mark and deliver the line and deliver it with conviction. Not just any line, but the line people want to hear. The line that makes them feel good about themselves. The line that pulls their chins up and straightens their spines and gives them some hope. And if the line is right and true and just, so much the better. And if the line is nothing but hollow sound wrapped in a wishful thought, they will love him for it anyway. Like they love a good movie that has no relation to reality, but that makes them feel the way they want to feel. My father is not a politician and does not traffic in votes or campaign dollars, but he has the same gift of knowing what to say and how to say it. He can, when he is on, when he is working the room, when the charm is flowing, he can deliver the lines people need to hear. And they love him for it. It is an ability that comes and goes, and I have in later years come to question just how much control over it he actually has. But when he's on, and there's nobody who can beat him. The walls could be coming down under heavy cannon fire, and my father would take it in stride, shaking hands, telling stories, telling people that everything was as it should be. Ah, the walls, yes. Well, a little fresh air is good for you. Reminds me of the time out on the back nine in a lightning storm with the governor and half of the bank board and Morgan Fairchild. And as the plaster rains down into open glasses of Chablis and Cabernet, they will love him. They will reach out for him. Hollis, over here, Hollis. Because when you feel like you have no control over your world, the line people want to hear is that you really do have control. Or you really don't need as much control as you think you do. Or that control is a delusion that only leads to the trouble of delusions, and that all you really need to know is that everything will be okay in the end. And none of this will sound or feel like a line, because it will not be a line. For that moment, swallowing all other moments, the line is the truth, and you will believe it completely because he believes it so completely. Believes it simply because he wants to believe it. And because he knows that in the singular moment, before the cops and the lawyers and the principals have their next say, there is no difference between wanting and being, between truth and line, between saying it and making it so. And it is the magic of my father, and maybe of most fathers, to make the world comprehensible again. I realize now that this is exactly what I need. I mark his progress in the reflection. It takes him another 15 minutes. "You hogging the Shiraz?" he asks. "Huh? Oh, no, it was just sitting here." I hand him the bottle and he refills his glass. "Been in his room?" "Yeah, you know how your mother gets at these sorts of things. It is the tone of male bonding over the silliness of women. So I hear May isn't feeling well. Stomach thing. She said she would try to be here." "You two okay?" "Us? Yeah, fine." Instinctively, I knit my brows, as though I am puzzled by the question, as though he had asked me if I liked tapioca pudding or if I was aware that most of the earth was covered by water. But, of course, I do not sound puzzled. I sound defensive. He gives me the look and the pursed lips and the slow nod that says he is a little amused by my lie, and that we will see how it all plays out in the end, and to make no mistake that he will be there when it does. He couldn't possibly know anything about my relationship, or non-relationship, with May, other than what I have told him, which is that everything is great, fine, super, aces, or other variations on that theme. But he does know. He always knows. Or at least seems to know. Intellectually, I understand the game. Intellectually, I understand that all he ever really knows is the possibility that there is something to know, that there is the ever-present possibility that, for instance, something is different in my relationship with May, a possibility that we have split, a possibility that we are planning to be married, a possibility that she is pregnant and that we are fighting over whether to keep the baby, and so on. If by some future revelation that turns out to be true, then his look and his pursed lips and his nod are all placeholders by which he can claim, to himself, if not to others, that he knew all along. And if, on the other hand, there is no revelation, no split, no marriage, no baby, then nothing ever comes of the look and the pursed lips and the nod, and he knew all along that nothing was particularly different in my relationship with May. And in fact, he has known all along that my relationship with May is one of those types of relationships in which nothing particularly different ever happens. At least until something different does happen, in which case it was something he saw coming from the very beginning. Intellectually, I understand that my father knows everything because his knowledge of the world is incredibly amoebic and plasticine and nonlinear, that it shapes and molds itself around evolving circumstances, seamlessly accommodating and incorporating new information, swapping out old information, spreading it out in all directions with no discernible head or tail, beginning or end, history or future, so that after all is said and done, it is a conveniently impossible task for him to distinguish between old and new understanding, between revelation and memory. Whatever he learns, he has always known. Intellectually, I get it. But emotionally, the fucker knows how to read minds. "How's the school this year so far?" he asks. "Oh, okay. New crop of freshmen." "You whipping them into shape?" "Trying." "Well, keep at it," he says. "Give any more thought to teaching at the college level?" The question is nothing new. He is nonchalant and unassuming and nonjudgmental and just curious and completely full of shit. Even when I know the question is coming, which is usually, it never loses its deflationary effect on my self-esteem, like letting the air out of a bicycle tire with a nail. I cross my arms to stop the leak. My father has slipped into lecture. "There are too many petty agendas at work in college faculties, and unless you're incredibly diligent about kissing the asses of the right people." As I tell him again, and with too much force, why I am not interested in a career in a post-secondary environment, I tell myself that my father is actually not disappointed in me, that he is actually so enamored with my potential that he cannot help but suggest to me, again and again, what he understands to be the next rung of the ladder I have chosen to climb for a living. He points his finger at me. "Whoever said that the university was the last bastion of true liberalism is full of crap. All you have to do is look at the new patterns in alumni fundraising." I watch his mouth move and tune out the sound he makes. I'm not so good at self-deception, and I know inescapably that he is disappointed in me, and that he wishes he could graduate me from his repertoire of apocrypha. Reminds me of the time that my older son, David, reeled in 2 trout on 1 hook to his repertoire of genuine credentials. And my older son, David, was just inducted into the Organization of American Historians and awarded the Bancroft Prize in American History for his book, The History of Existence, which has also, by the way, made the Pulitzer nominations. Of course, even there I come up short, for I know he would like to be claiming that his older son, David, is a moving and shaking investment banker in Manhattan, pulling in 7 or 8 or 9 figures a year. There is a line about acorns and trees that he wants to use. That line, and the "taught him everything he knows" line. But we both know that my life is hardly a monument to things my father has taught me. He taught me how to golf. I hate golf. He taught me how to fish. I do not fish. He taught me the value of saving and investing and preached the gospel of compounded interest, and yet I am always broke. He sang the songs of the marketplace and of building great cities and of people with the vision and courage to pioneer new ventures. New ventures. Trailblazing. The future. But I teach history. History. I teach history in the same high school that once gave me a D in algebra and that now has suspended me on suspicion of crimes against children. He is not listening to the defense of my career choice. Neither am I, really. We have had this conversation before. As I extol the freshness and exhilaration of high school academe, he is scanning the window behind me, and I am looking at the front door behind him. May is not coming. I know this now with a visceral certainty, and I relax. He changes the subject to Bethany Cohen. He's quite taken with her academic credentials and her personal ambition and her professional promise and other qualities I do not possess. I am waiting to hear about her golf game and her love for fishing. Instead, it turns out she is Japanese. Go figure. He wants my impressions, and notwithstanding her tolerance for Mike O'Donnell, I give her a decent review. Her father is a big-shot banker in Japan. He is showing her around to help his friend. School in Columbia. Wants a master's in business. Mother dead. Tragic boat fire. Blah, blah, blah. Now I am not listening to him. I want desperately to cut through the shit. I want to tell him that I'm in trouble and scared and that I need him to be the great communicator. That there are things that I need to hear and that I need him to deliver the line. The line that I don't believe at first, but that he believes just enough in the moment to make it true. The line that I will take home with me tonight and tuck under my pillow. I need him to give me the look and purse the lips and nod the head and tell me that all of this mess is entirely predictable and to be expected and that everything will turn out all right, because none of this is particularly surprising. And that because he has always known something like this would come along, and because he will take care of things. And then I need a hug. I need him to put down the fucking wine and to cross the goddamn physical barrier between father and grown son that may as well be the fucking Grand Canyon, and that does not seem to exist between mothers and daughters, or mothers and sons, or between women of any age, or between men and women, or even between my father and his closer male contemporaries. I need him to tell me everything will work out fine, and I need him to seal the deal with arms around shoulders and to make it true. Dad, part of me cannot believe I'm about to get this out. I look into the backyard at the pale pool of light framing Ben's shadow, laughing in the wind. I can't find the words, and realize that now, here, the party, is probably not appropriate. I am a chicken shit. Maybe later we can talk, I sputter, blushing. I get the knowing smile, and then the pursed lips, the look that understands everything, the precursor to the line. I'm ashamed and look away, scanning the backyard, hoping strangely that my stuttering had been enough to spark the dialogue I wanted.
"You live in a nice place for a high school history teacher, David. Once we get the mortgage paid off, it will be a good investment for you."
"Dad, no, that's not... And I saw your car out on the street."
"Oh," I respond as casually as I can. Inside, all I feel is dread.
Inside, the word "oh" is short for, "Oh, fuck, he saw the car."
"You know, vandalism like that doesn't happen in university parking lots," he says.
"Yeah."
"Did they catch them?" he asks.
"No."
"Any idea why they did it?"
"It is my chance. It is an opening to the truth, and all I need to do is step into the light. But I do not have what it takes. I see his face, not as it is here and now, but as it was over there at the dining room table, decades ago, in his creaking chair with his glass of wine. It's probably the same damn glass. Talking to me about responsibility and consequences for those who do not have the sense to exercise good judgment, and about how Inga and Heinrich Van Susteren were not pressing charges for all their stupid precious dead fish scattered across their ruined new floor, but how if I did not turn my brain on, I would one day be sitting in a police station.
No, I say, no idea. It's what vandals do, I guess.
He squints at me.
Well, a new paint job will set you back. That and a mortgage payment. He considers his fingers reflectively, a banker doing basic math. Let's say about 2,000. Will that help?
I cannot answer him and turn away. He thinks I am hitting him up for a handout. Which I am, but that was never the real point. And the handout, if that is the truth of things, was to be a special emergency sort of handout for things like serious criminal legal defense fees, not ordinary monthly handouts like mortgage payments or even shit happens handouts like new paint jobs for inexplicably vandalized civics. I'm staring at Ben in the pool of light. Suddenly my father's hand, carrying his misplaced, well-intentioned consolation and all of his kindly suspended disappointment, is on my shoulder. I am the prodigal son who never really left in the first place.
"Don't worry about it, David," says my father. "I'm happy to do it."
I am saved, again, by my mother, who is trying to get everyone's attention.
"Oh, here we go," says Dad. "Your mother's banging a glass. This will be interesting."
And it is interesting. Unless you've seen it a billion times before. My mother and father waging the same battle for control and respect that they have waged forever. Even, as now, within the velvet interstices of the words they speak in polite society. They pull mightily at opposite ends of the same rope of woven flesh and hair and money and sex and children and time that emerges from each of them, and that connects them like two knots that are the product of rope and years upon years of pulling. I do what I've trained myself to do when I hear the rope creaking and groaning. I check out. I look into the backyard and think of other things. May. Prison. The food. The cellmate. The showers. I am dimly aware of a tussle over whether the woman in a sport coat and a tattoo with an aggressive fondness for crab cakes, I've already forgotten her name, should tell the story about Mom's speech at the Finger Hut rally. It is a story my father pretends not to hate, just as he pretends not to hate Eric Finger Hut. The conversation devolves into the barely polite social equivalent of the "do not do so" and the "stop pointing at me, Mom, David's pointing at me" and the "liar, liar, pants on fire" games that Tilly and I played in the back seat of the sky blue station wagon on the drive to Yosemite.
"Oh, Hollis, you did, sitting right over there at that table. He did. He said he hated Eric Finger Hut. David heard it, didn't you, David?"
She wants a rescue. She wants me to come charging in to back her up.
Of course he said it. I hate Eric Fingerhut. Or words to that effect. I was there. I heard it. But so what? What is the meaning of any one battle in an interminable war? And what's in it for me to intervene? Further alienation from my father? Disdain for abdicating my independence and allowing myself to be taken in and co-opted by her petty agenda? The next time I will be compelled by my own enslaving sense of fairness to speak up for him against her. He's right, Mom. You know you were closer to 20 minutes late. And what will that get me? A cold shoulder for providing aid and comfort to the enemy? Leave me out of this, Mom, I say, aware everyone is listening. Ben's shadow is motionless on the lawn, a dark black granite stanchion stretching out toward the cotoneasters, which I know only means that the song has ended. I know that the only time my brother is connected to the world that I, even superficially, inhabit tonight is in those 3-second intervals between one tune and the next, between Hakuna Matata and The Lion Sleeps Tonight. I wonder what he thinks of the noise from down the hall that seeps beneath his door and rises up from the silence between the songs in his ears. I wonder if he is heartbroken. I wonder if he cares. My father is introducing his Japanese friend with all of her great breeding and education and bankable success. Sure, but let's see her teeth, Dad. How hard does she run on the inside, crowded against the rail? She is insufferably sweet and pleasant and gracious, and I want to empty my wine glass over her blonde hair and yellow dress, and this is when I realize, for the first time, just what a shitty mood I am in. Because there is really nothing at all offensive or objectionable about this person. Quite the contrary. Under different circumstances. Christ. What? I'd ask her out? Great, Dave. Well, what is it? Do you hate her guts? Or want to have sex with her? It is my sister's voice that leavens my mood a little. It has been at least 2 years since I've seen her. Well, less than 40 feet tall, anyway. And we are only infrequently in telephone contact. I do not have the money, and I suspect she does not have the inclination. But I hear her voice, and I miss her deeply. My little sister. The one with all the piss and vinegar and rage. The one who has always had my father's number and who always, always had the courage to show it to him. The one who piled up all the strength, smarts, ambition, against-the-odds perseverance, and the in-your-face, this is my only life and I'm gonna make the most of it perspicacity allocated to the John's children, and took it all for herself, because she knew that she was the only one who would ever do anything with it. Stuffed it all into a ratty denim purse, slung it over her shoulder, and walked out of the house in the middle of the night, and never looked back. I hear her voice rising out of the little white speaker on the floor as she speaks to the shoes of people she cannot see, receiving their congratulations. And I miss her, and I am in awe all over again. And your brother David is here. Hey, sis.
Hey, big bro. You doing okay? Whipped the 9th grade into shape yet?
Well, not exactly. Congratulations, Tilly. I'm real proud.
Thanks, Dave. I miss you. Come see me when you can.
Do you have room for about 150 high school freshmen?
Tilly, this is Mom. David was hoping May would be able to join us, but she is very, very sick. Or at least she was, and might still be very, very sick, but I know she really wanted to be here, and so far she's not, so...
Oh, well, that's a big shame, Mom.
That my sister is less than fond of May is no big secret. The reasons are mysterious. She has never told me, and I have never asked. It is an intuitive vibe or a competitive instinct. I'm relieved, suddenly, that May is not here. I feel a little bad for her, my sister, having to endure this obligatory telephonic adulation. I suppose she is coming to terms with stardom. I suppose she has to. But still.
Japanese Barbie makes the mistake of telling my sister that my father has been invoking the Buddha to sing her praises.
Oh?
I can tell from her voice that this is the first time Tilly has taken a genuine interest in the conversation. I can almost hear her rolling up her sleeves.
Yes, dear,
says Mom with an unnatural cheer in her voice. She is anticipating the pylon.
Your father is quoting the Buddha again.
Well then, let's hear it.
Tilly, I know you're busy, so let's raise our glasses. My father has his glass raised as though he is in an opera, waving a pewter goblet at the back seats.
No, seriously,
insists Tilly.
Just what does the Buddha have to say about me? I'd really like to know. I bet Bethany remembers.
Bethany looks uncertainly at my father, who has crossed his arms and is staring fixedly at the carpet.
It was something like, it is a wise father that knows his own child. And he said that he felt wise because he always knew.
I hate to break it to you, but that's Shakespeare, not Buddha. And worse yet, it's a perversion of the original line from Homer.
I almost choke on my last swallow of wine and get looks of concern from Mickey Dobbs and Rhonda, each of whom cranes their neck around to find the source of the gasp.
Really, dear? My mom asks, innocently, deeply interested for the very first time in Homerian pearls. What's the original line?
It's like watching tag team wrestling gone horribly wrong, and I want to close my eyes. Tilly pauses before answering.
It is a wise child that knows her own father.
Slam.
Oh, my, Mom exclaims, looking around from face to face. You're so smart sometimes I can't even stand it.
Pow. Okay, Tilly, I know you're busy. Dad raises the pewter goblet again, yet higher. So we are going to raise our glasses to you in recognition of this great honor.
I prefer Oscar Wilde myself.
Smack.
You're always so good with writers, dear. What did he say?
Children begin by loving their parents. After a time, they judge them. Rarely, if ever, do they forgive them.
Ooh, that's gotta hurt. Okay, let's raise our glasses. But Mom still will not cede control of the evening to my father. For that is what the toast is all about. Who controls the show? My father is better at it, and they both know it. He has something to say, and it will be funny and wise and endearing and perfectly extemporaneous, and they will love him for it. Ah, Hollis, how lovely! Bravo! Hear, hear! But it's not his party. Not really, anyway. And they both know that, too. My mother knows she has leaned on Tilly's smarts and conspired to have her fun with the Buddha and Homer. She knows that paybacks are hell, and that they have reached the part where she loses ownership of her own party, and so she is struggling to stay on top.
Wait, wait, Hollis, we still have to do the reviews.
The glass comes down, and my mom stoops toward the phone on the floor.
Sweetie, we had everyone here do reviews of your performance in Peppermint Grove, and we're going to read...
She rattles on. Not that my mom could never deliver a good speech, or make a good toast, or work the crowd to great effect. She can, and has. Just ask Gail. But she knows that it, whatever that may be, is not really in her. She knows her successes in this regard to have been flukes of fortune, wrinkles in the fabric of her own identity. My mother knows herself to be an inferior. That's the only way to say it. Not in everything. Not in raising children. Not in taking care of the home front. Not in looking good, or in understanding the social rules by which we must live, or in seeing the surface of life. It's mostly just in speaking, the conveyance of true meaning with words, and in thinking and in understanding how it all comes together beneath the surface that she is lacking. She knows she is lacking depth. Whatever her successes, what she knows is that they are all successes delivered in the shallow end of the pool, and, unlike my father, she knows she is not a good swimmer, and that, after all, the pool is only but so big. Admitted or not, true or not, that is what she knows of herself, and that knowledge
maybe more than anything else, has been the glue that has seeped into every nook and cranny of the marriage, where long ago it has hardened and binds together this thing, this holiest of unions, that no man shall tear asunder.
Oh, God,
says Tilly.
Mom.
There is genuine anguish in my sister's voice, and I smother the instinct to help her by ripping the phone cord out of the wall. With the exception of Peaches Pinkle and Rhonda Davenport, most of the reviews are breathless and awful, and therefore surprisingly authentic-sounding. I'm watching my father urge Bethany forward with reassuring nods. She cringes. He nods. She winces. He nods. She smiles, biting her lip uncertainly. He nods. Christ. Who's next? Bethany straightens herself and steps up to the phone. Now I am cringing and biting my lip.
I'll go, Mrs. Johns. I'll go next.
It's Susan. Susan, please, says my mother, smiling through irritation only my father and I are capable of detecting.
Go ahead, Bethany.
Okay, thanks. Hi again, Tilly. This is me, Bethany Cohen. Hi. Okay, here's my review. Okay, gosh, I'm nervous. This is so exciting. Okay, here I go.
She reads from her slip of paper. People are exclaiming, applauding. Even Tilly sounds impressed. My father is beaming, and he squeezes her on the shoulder. She smiles and shrugs and beams back at him, showing her teeth. I do not dwell on the fact that Bethany's review is 10 times better than anything I could have come up with in 2 minutes at a table of appetizers surrounded by strangers, nor that she so easily commands my father's admiration. I content myself with the acknowledgement that it was better than I had expected, and I remind myself that she admires Mike O'Donnell. And I move on.
Well, okay, who's next?
My mother perches her eyebrows and opens her palms in my direction.
David, it's your turn.
Crap. I step away from the window and move an inch closer to the group. Tilly.
Yes, Dave.
You will be delighted to know that, because I love you, I have conscientiously objected to this whole idea. I am not blurbing your work.
You are a kind and loving brother.
But if I did blurb your movie, it would probably have something to do with paying almost $10 to see more of your ass than your face. It is a childish taunt, but she expects nothing less, and I will not disappoint her by being appropriate or sycophantic. We respect one another in the codes of our upbringing.
Ha, ha, ha.
If you could teach that thing to emote, then maybe you'd have something.
David!
Mom is genuinely appalled.
Gee, thanks, Dave,
says Tilly. By the way, my students want me to tell you that you are a goddess. I get much more attention and respect as your publicity agent than as a history teacher.
That's enough of that, says Mom. Shame on you for not doing a review, David. Luckily, I anticipated that you would be a party pooper, so I wrote one for you and May. So don't think you can just... Oh, look who's here.
I do not know how to react or what to think or how to feel, so I just stand there. May is in the foyer, suddenly, soundlessly, like she is grown out of the floor. She's here. May is here.